This is Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your radio tuned to the left and your mind in the open position as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
Today I'm speaking again with Mark Derry. He's a culture critic extraordinaire from the New York Hudson Valley. And I'd previously interviewed him about his volume called Escape Velocity, Cyberculture at the End of the Century, which had caught my eye because it talks about body loathing, something that I'm as prone to as any other person involved in cyberculture. And especially now that I'm approaching 40 and fat and flatulent. And his take on that had really been very provocative, ranging across many different cultural products and cutting edge art and all the way to kids' television programming, that kind of thing. So his most recent volume is even more nonlinear, gestaltish take on a variety of topics having to do with contemporary culture. It's called Pyrotechnic and Sanitarium, American Culture on the Brink. Welcome, Mark Derry.
Great to be here.
Your novel, well, it's not a novel, but it reads very entertainingly, almost like a novel.
I'm flattered to hear that.
Really, every single sentence in your book seems to show an amount of cultural absorption that is mind-boggling, because you seem to be plugged into every nook and cranny. The chapter on Munch's scream, where you cross-reference about 50 or 100 different uses of Munch's scream, was particularly memorable in that respect.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment. In a strange way, I replicate one of my own critiques at one point in the book, which is a meditation, as the subtitle suggests, on America on the brink, American culture on the eve of the future at the turn of the millennium, moments before the cultural chronometer zeroes out. I talk about conspiracy theory as reflecting the connectionist sensibility of Casaubon, one of the paranoid semioticians and medieval exegetes in Umberto Eco's novel Foucault's Pendulum. And at one point in the book, Casaubon says, I think of everything always connecting, connecting. He's haunted by the demon of intertextuality. Every textual reference seems to hang suspended in a kind of intellectual spider web for him, to be a kind of an intellectual node point, suggesting endless intertextual connections spinning out hypertextually through all of literary history. And in a way, that's the way my own mind works. I have a kind of a magpie intellect that's drawn to anything glinting in the off-scourings and effluvia of popular culture. So I'm constantly warehousing curious little, you know, tidbits of curiosa that seem as if they add up to something or seem to emblematize or crystallize some of the deeper tendencies of our culture. And I also tend to take note of replicating icons or glyphs or symbols. So when I saw Edvard Munch's scream starting to proliferate in popular culture, it's almost reflexive in me that I start to catalog instances of that. And when they kind of reach critical mass, then they seem to mean something to my mind.
Well, you actually foreshadow one of the issues I want to raise about your method, which is the central point of Foucault's Pendulum, that once you have the paranoid frame of mind, everything connects together, whether there's an authenticatable connection or not. That, mm-hmm. You know, that the world looks a certain way, and I think one of the overarching themes of your book, America on the Brink, is that there is, as you say here in the first kind of overarching chapter, in the final analysis, the economic upheaval, social tensions, moral vertigo of our moment are historically unique. The sweeping economic and techno-scientific process of the development of capitalism, which has dominated the last two centuries, in the words of Hobsbawm, has brought us to a point of historical crisis. And you are looking at contemporary events as reflective of some kind of unique historical process in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the questions I would raise is whether we're actually that unique, whether or not the things that you point out are merely contemporary reflections of a trans-historical set of human conditions.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of quality, but rather of quantity. I think we are unique in degree, in that I think that everything is, to use a term from the children's book Homer Price, ever so much more so. Those of you who grew up in the 50s and 60s who may remember the Homer Price books may recall the story where a stranger comes to town peddling quack nostrums, and one of them is what looks like a salt shaker that appears to be empty, but purportedly contains an invisible concoction which, when sprinkled on anything, makes it ever so much more so. Ever so much more so, whatever it is. And I think we live in a moment that has not torn loose from its moorings in history. The world was not created anew while we rolled over in our sleep, but it is ever so much more so extreme that everything, a lot of the mega trends and technological shifts and economic dynamics of our society are kind of amplified by orders of magnitude. So, for example, what I was trying to do in the passage you read was to countervail millennial voodoo numerology, the notion that because we're approaching some sort of calendric singularity, that everything, is weird, that the gyre is widening, that everything that isn't tied down is coming loose. I wanted to countervail that with a hard sort of post-Marxist historical materialism and suggest that there are very real reasons for the cultural chaos that many seem to see all around us. And foremost among them are the automation of manufacturing processes and the cybernation of manufacturing and all the dynamics that flow from the computer revolution, as well as the globalization of capital. And those two developments do seem to me to mark symmetry breaks with all of history.
So there may have been rapid social change in earlier eras, but the rapidity and constantness of the rapidity of change now is fundamentally different.
It's not only that, but also, and I am hardly a Promethean firebringer when I say these things. These ideas don't spring full-blown from my brow, and they'll be familiar to many of your listeners. But, for example, the notion that things are speeding up, both literally speeding up in terms of the sheer velocity of everyday existence, the ceaseless radioactive media bombardment, the kind of hyperkinetic all-at-onceness of everything, to use Marshall McLuhan's term, the jump-cutting, channel-surfing, sort of remote-control zapping, web-trolling ontology of late 20th century, multinational America, is inarguably faster than the plodding agrarian time frame of America, 150 to 200 years ago. So that's a commonplace of social criticism. But also we're seeing the gyre tightening and the feedback loop starting to spiral in on itself in terms of things like, for example, popular culture trends. The distance between subcultural gesture of resistance and mainstream co-optation, the sort of evisceration, flaying, and strip mauling of subcultural rituals of resistance is collapsing. So the moment between sort of undercultural, grungy, semiotic gesture of rebellion and its appearance in the grunge section of Macy's is now collapsing to just about nil.
The hipness of capitalism.
Exactly. And similarly, I mean, J.G. Ballard, the science fiction author, famously observed in his introduction in 1984 to his novel Crash that the future is obsolete. We live in a world of yesterday's tomorrows, that the very notion of the future has collapsed into the present, arrogated into the sphere of the all-encroaching, sort of omnivorously devouring present, the notion being that technological speed-up has reached this sort of giddy, vertiginous pace where things are obsolete almost before they're popularly disseminated. I mean, the classic example of that is virtual reality. Mm-hmm. The technology that ever only really existed as vaporware, killed off by media hype in the age of attention deficit disorder. So we've all been subject to the sort of dizzy conjurations of John Perry Barlow and Jaron Lanier, the point men for virtual reality, and so the reality of it never matched up to the media simulacrum, and therefore people lost interest in the early virtual reality headgear. Now looks as archaic as Victorian phenakistoscopes, you know, magic lantern helmets, you know, from 100 years ago. And I think actually that emblematizes a new sort of technology which will only exist as vaporware. Commodities will exist only as media simulacra and will kind of live out their whole brief crabgrass-like existences in the hothouse vivarium of global media.
Let me push you once more.
Pardon my filibuster, but I had to tile those threads together.
That's fine. That's what you do. I want to push it, though. I want to push this, one of the themes that you write about, which is the growing affectlessness and kind of joyous schadenfreude that people have in our culture, laughing at others' misfortune, laughing at freaks, mm-hmm. Laughing at horror, at surgical porn, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm struck by, for instance, a vision of an old Puritan village where unfortunate widow who slept with the postman would be in stocks, or mm-hmm. where there would be public hangings or public beheadings or public whippings or whatever. And I just wonder whether I think that the progressive political vision is that, for instance, with the current war in Serbia, mm-hmm. is that our sympathies, however attenuated, our sympathies for the Albanians being thrust out of their countries is fundamentally different today than our sympathies would have been for a cultural and religious other 100, 200, 300 years ago, where mm-hmm. we wouldn't have cared at all, and we definitely wouldn't have committed any resources to their defense.
Well, it's a fascinating question, and you put it in a very nuanced, subtly modulated fashion, and for that I commend you. I think it's a smart question to raise. Essentially, what you're suggesting is that McLuhan was right when he talked about the notion of global interconnectedness conjured up for him by the sort of quasi or crypto neo-colonial vision of the global village. The idea that in the age of instant media, we are all a quote-unquote family of man, to use that 60s phrase.
Mm-hmm.
What I would suggest in response is that you're partly right, in my opinion. There's no doubt that images of, you know, starving children in Mogadishu mobilized almost in the blink of an eye a global effort. But one thing we have to think about is that American empire is extremely selective about the tears it sheds. And so, for example, you know, we have very belatedly some concern now about the slaughter of the innocents in Albania, and yet only a few years ago you can kind of rewind the media tape of CNN and see White House press secretaries parsing the definition of the term genocide as the butchery of untold thousands and tens of thousands proceeded apace in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
So Interesting to note that when the faces are darker, the crimes against humanity seem to be somewhat more easy to swallow. I mean, this is a really incendiary point I'm making, obviously, but my point is kind of Chomsky-esque, which is that, you know, American empire extends its hand, across the globe, and always rides into battle with righteous cause kind of flapping from its standard. But it's important to kind of peel back the rhetoric sometimes and see what's underneath.
So that our sympathies may be as orchestrated as the Crusades were in the Middle Ages.
Well, it's not just that, but, I mean, if you raise the notion that the juxtaposition you were setting up was Hester Prynne's America, the America, presumably, of the Puritans, who, in all fairness, were far less repressive and draconian than they've been made out to be. But having said that, you set up this kind of binary opposition where you said, on the one hand, in Arthur Dimmesdale's America, the old crone who had the misfortune to look sort of suspicious might have ended up clapped in the stocks for the merest infraction on a Sabbath day.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, we feel a sense of global empathy for people we will never know and never meet and with whom we might have very little in common.
Mm-hmm.
I would just say, on the other side of the scale pan, you have to set a pebble for the cynical viewpoint, which points out that humanitarian organizations talk forever and always these days about empathy burn, about the fact that the very media which can galvanize public support for humanitarian missions can also jangle our nerves raw to the point where we feel nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And one has to wonder if, the Holocaust were the stuff of round-the-clock Geraldo Rivera coverage, if people would have been any more mobilized than they actually were at that moment. So the media can both galvanize people, but it can also have a sort of a Cronenbergian video drama effect where it numbs and enervates us and flays our nerve ends raw, but finally deadens and desensitizes them.
Okay, let's rewind for a second and explain the title of your book. It comes from Coney Island Luna Park, the pyrotechnic and sanitarium?
Right, and a turn-of-the-century critic in the late 19th century, which was when most of the major attractions at Coney, most of the major parks were built. There were actually several parks, Dreamland, Steeplechase, and Luna Park were the three major parks there. And one of the first newspaper critics to see Coney at night, you actually had to arrive there by boat because initially there was no subway. So you approached Coney from the sea, and it was the largest collection of electric light bulbs in the world at that point, casting an infernal sulfurous glow, kind of a lambent flame into the foggy night ocean air. And it was, by all reports, an absolutely sublime, delirious, surrealistic experience. And a newspaper critic referred to Coney as a pyrotechnic insanitarium, a marvelous, pungent phrase that I think conjures up the notion of Coney Island as an emblem of the id unchained, a kind of paradise of libidinous, polymorphous perversity. And there's actually a spectacular photo, I think from about 1911, of Sigmund Freud standing at Coney Island at night, surrounded by this luminous halo of electrical lights. And he's standing on a bridge over a kind of a mock Chinese canal, and above him are clearly legible the words Dreamland. But I use, in my book, the sobriquet Pyrotechnic and Sanitarium for America at the end of the millennium as a way of conjuring up my vision of America as on the one hand, a deeply repressive, hidebound, pinched, mean-spirited, censorious, paranoid, evil empire that has given us the electric chair, sort of slaughter bench 5 o'clock news, the snuff film, the Golden Arches, you know, in Disneyland. And on the other hand, you know, America as this playground of polymorphous perversity that does have these transgressive impulses rippling beneath its surface. So the book is neither some sort of neo-puritanical, in the left or right-wing sense, Jeremiad about the corrosions of popular culture, but nor is it some sort of zero forehead, smiley face embrace of you know, popular culture as an antidote to all that ails us. Mm-hmm. I look at the notion that the gyre is widening and everything that's not tied down is coming loose, and I suggest that that is in part just voodoo numerology, mere millennial anxiety that we saw at the year 2000, and yet at the same time that there are true reasons to be concerned in terms of the widening gap between rich and poor and some of the corrosions of global capitalism. And then finally, I also suggest that some of this chaos is not all to the bad, that identity politics and some of the small groups now clamoring for recognition, whether it's transgendered people, gay activists, you know, people of color and so forth, that that's a wonderful salutary development, and that if we're seeing hairline cracks in the pediments of patriarchal power, well, that's marvelous and an entirely healthy development, in my opinion.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Derry, author of Pyrotechnic and Sanitarium. And since I'm involved in community public radio here and doing a talk show, radical talk show of sorts, I was particularly struck by your juxtaposition of public, or rather of television talk shows as kind of a pro-transgressive alternative to right-wing talk radio, which is the dominant talk radio form in the country. And could you say something about that? Why do you think that television has been more open to transgressive and progressive views than talk radio?
Well, a fascinating question, and I don't have a pat answer for that particular question, which I'll have to turn over in my mind a little more.
I had one suggestion. It could be because the daytime talk radio is oriented towards women, you know, women who are at home.
Well, you're quite right, and in fact, I make that very point in the book, although I don't frame it quite that way. Mm-hmm. But I do explicitly say, just as a matter of record, that daytime talk television throughout its entire history, and it sprang largely from the brow, of course, of Phil Donahue, has been entirely a female phenomenon, or overwhelmingly a female phenomenon, targeting the niche market, or not-so-niche market, of housewives. Mm-hmm. And talk radio, at least the most popular, really incendiary species of talk radio, have been rightward-leaning, overwhelmingly male phenomena. Mm-hmm. That particular point floats in the middle of a chapter about the return of the freak show, mm-hmm. and specifically that discussion swirls in my book around the use of the term freak show to demonize watchers of daytime talk shows. And what I try to do is countervail the sort of puritanical moral crusading rhetoric of people like William Bennett who want to, you know, flay the hide of Jerry Springer. It's sort of a bring me the head of, you know, Oprah mentality. Mm-hmm. I look at the very selective, again, conscience of people like William Bennett who provides tip sheets for right-wing radio jocks, you know, people like G. Gordon Liddy who are advising their audiences to shoot for the head of ATF agents when they have the temerity to knock on their doors. So I look at what is truly corrosive to the public sphere. I look at what is really gnawing hollow public discourse and notions of commonality in late 20th century America. And it seems to me if we're going to lay the burden of guilt anywhere, we should lay the burden of guilt at the doorstep of people like G. Gordon Liddy rather than someone like, you know, Sally Jesse Raphael, who has been unwittingly, I'm not suggesting that she's any great standard bearer for cultural enlightenment, But these forums have been taken over and used by gay and transgendered people in recent history to air their issues and openly sort of extol the delights of their sexuality. And the response of the audience or of television critics is not the entire story. I mean, one thing that cultural criticism in the academy teaches us is that the engines of production and the top-down dominant culture disseminators of entertainment aren't the whole story. How people receive these stories and reweave them or perversely misread them, the popular culture glosses on what's flowing out of the television into our living rooms, are every bit as important. So I'm saying the guests on these shows, as manipulated as they are, as demonized as they sometimes are, and the fact that the shows clearly kneel at the altar of mammon and are ultimately consecrated to the bottom line, in no way hollows out some of the monkey-wrenching and hijacking that the guests do on these shows. And many gay activists have pointed out in thinking and talking about these shows that they were one of the first public fora for gay people being openly, happily gay, as opposed to Hollywood representations of gay folks on the big screen and the little screen. So control of one's image in the postmodern arena of image politics and the politics of the image in a retinal culture is of paramount importance and shouldn't be downplayed.
I know you have to go in a minute. I did read, there are many, many topics I wanted to address, and people are just going to have to read your book to find out, for instance, why America hates and fears clowns, which is one of the more provocative chapters.
Well, we can take a minute or two. I have a little bit of wiggle room. If you'd like to talk for another 5 minutes, we can do that.
Okay, let's. I wanted to address one of the points. We talk a lot about the promise and perils of biotech on this because mm-hmm. I'm a self-fancied bioethicist.
Mm-hmm.
And I have often been impressed with Shulamith Firestone, one of the first Marxist feminists, her book, A Dialectic of Sex, which you mentioned in your mm-hmm. Book as well, which argued that reproductive technology would liberate women from pregnancy, and that was one of the preconditions for the liberation of women as a whole. And, of course, the majority of feminist bioethics criticism has focused on reproductive technology as a way of controlling women or of stealing reproductive fire from women.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like one of the few places in all of your oeuvre that I've seen so far where you come close to having a policy prescription is that you argue Shulamith's case, that you think that reproductive technology may actually have more liberative impact than feminist bioethicists imagine. Is that true?
Not entirely. I actually suggest that she builds her argument on a rather rotten cornerstone or keystone, which is, it strikes me as passing strange that feminism, which begins from the notion that difference is a salutary development and should be celebrated, ends up denying difference or wanting to avert its face from difference or blind itself to difference. In other words, I think the notion of a universe where there is a proliferation of polymorphous perversities in various sexual appetites and genders is a sort of a delightful Hieronymus Boschian fantasia to me. And I believe in the sort of Maoist notion of letting 100 flowers bloom. The problem with radical feminist separatist science fictional postmodern visions of some sort of sapphic geosynchronous orbital colony where women clone themselves through far future technologies and thereby render men obsolete is that it's terribly monolithic and monovocal. It seems to deny difference and fear difference, and I find that at least mildly repugnant. So I was actually invoking her in my argument, and as well as Valerie Solanas, of course, makes rather the same argument that men should be rendered obsolete and that through cloning and various forms of mm-hmm. post-human technological intervention, women will be able to replicate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the deep fear of difference that springs from this, and it seems to me that the fear of difference is the buried engine that animates misogyny. And it seems to me that misogyny is the catalytic spark that creates the feminist consciousness. So there seems to be a kind of an odd hypocrisy embedded in that whole notion, if you follow me.
Mm-hmm. One final Teletubbies.
Did that answer your question?
It did. I'm prone to the belief in techno liberation, so mm-hmm. I always have to rein it back in with my hard-edged cynicism of the mind against that optimism of the will.
Right. Well, I take your point. I think it's a fascinating one. One of the things that I was looking at in the essay you're referring to, and for your listeners who haven't read the book, it's an essay on male pregnancy, on
right.
the notion that there are just over the horizon the technological means to make men pregnant, and a researcher at a hospital in London who was involved in the invention of the pill talked very seriously on the record about this recently. It was the idea behind the Arnold Schwarzenegger stillborn comedy Junior, the idea that you fertilize an egg, implant it in the omentum, which is a fatty layer of tissue that hangs like an apron over our internal organs, just around the belly, and that the egg could then be grown to term inside the male belly and delivered through something rather like a cesarean section. This has already been done purportedly with a male baboon.
Right.
So what I do is I look at Dolly and the media discourse that swirled around the cloning of Dolly and the numerous invocations of the Frankenstein myth as a pry bar for popping the lid off Dolly and explaining it and rummaging around inside it in search of its deeper meanings, and I suggest to the reader that what's going on behind the gauzy scrim of all the media coverage of Dolly is the dream of male pregnancy.
Right.
And I also talk about the ways in which men have historically intervened between women and their bodies. But I think pregnancy and the embodiedness that some women say they feel as a result of being women, and I'm not suggesting that's inherently an aspect of being female, is a marvelous way of reconnecting with the body. And I think that the notion of sort of experiencing that embodiedness is a marvelous counterweight to the disembodying dynamic of postmodern computer culture.
That's a great place to end. Thank you for being with us today, Mark.
My pleasure entirely. Thanks so much for your interest.
We look forward to your next volume.
Great. Take care.
You too.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.